I'll call the meeting for the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to order and open a hearing, an informational hearing on that subject. Before we introduce our first guest this morning, a couple of housekeeping items here. First of all, last meeting we had problems with a lot of buzz through the audio system, and the folks downstairs tell us that that's because someone had either a cell phone or a BlackBerry or whatever turned on. So if everybody could check their devices here right now and turn them off, it'll make it a lot easier on the folks. This morning, there it goes. It's buzzing already.
Buzzing already?
Yeah.
I'm the conflict maybe.
There we go. Thank you, Vice Chair. Today, we were intending to have a national perspective, and we will undoubtedly get that. We had a couple of invited folks, not surprisingly, from around the country who are very, very busy people, and one from the Chamber of Commerce, one from a Fortune 500 company who left Oregon. Both of them want very badly to come here and speak to us, and we will fit them in at a later time. With that, our first invited guest, we're very fortunate to have had someone come a very long distance from Washington, D.C. His return to Oregon was one of our own, Bob Baugh, who's going to be talking to us today about the inevitability, hopefully an ability to turn around deindustrialization. Our committee had discussions over the past couple of meetings about the decline of industrialization and the consequential decline in earnings capacity in many of the jobs here. And with that, Bob, if you'd please introduce yourself for the record, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Robert Baugh. I'm the Executive Director of the AFL-CIO Industrial Union Council out of Washington, D.C., and the Industrial Union Council is comprised of the manufacturing unions in the country, and we represent several millions of workers who work in the manufacturing sectors across the United States. It is an honor to come and speak to this committee. It's almost 20 years to the day that I came here. I was testifying, in fact, on behalf of a new administration at that time, and I was working in economic development. And I'd worked with this committee for 8 years prior to that as Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And much of what I have to say to you today and the information I've given you is based upon experiences that grew out of working here, representing and working for the working people of Oregon. I've given you testimony, and it's called the Agenda for Shared Prosperity. And just so you understand what it is, it really touches on a number of the documents I've given you. This article called "Is Deindustrialization Inevitable?" we published last summer. A brand new white paper from the Economic Policy Institute on globalization that works for working Americans. A publication from my council on revitalizing American manufacturing, state and local strategies. And a guide to economic development, a high road guide to economic development that I wrote a few years ago. So my comments will be brief. I just want to make a couple points in the next 5 minutes or so based upon the testimony. One is that I believe, and I know this committee believes, that manufacturing is an integral part of the Oregon economy and every other economic development department in the country that I've ever talked to feels the same way, that it's important for their economies, it's important for the standard of living. And it is an absolute crisis across the country. This state lost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs from 1998 through 2006. It is true for the entire country. The numbers are devastating. Over 3 million manufacturing jobs disappeared between 2000 and 2006. Another 100,000 disappeared just last year. 40,000 manufacturing establishments closed. We run a trade deficit, a current account deficit in this nation. It's going to hit $900 billion this year. We run a trade deficit with China that will hit $230 billion this year. We have an accumulated foreign debt of nearly $3 trillion, and we borrow $2 billion a day just to pay for the goods we consume. This is dangerous, and even the most mainstream and conservative economists admit this is unsustainable to be spending 6 to 7% of your gross domestic product to consume things and pay for things that we consume that are made elsewhere. It is only part of a broader picture of what's happened with globalization. It's been very damaging and devastating to working people both here and abroad. We've seen deindustrialization that's tied in the United States to some of these globalization policies, but in other countries we've seen deregulation, privatization, deunionization, a lack of work standards, worker rights, and environmental standards that all serve to undermine the rights of workers in those countries to become productive, to be consumers themselves. And at the same time, it undercuts the standards in our own country, because this is the kinds of pressures that have been brought to bear on the wage and benefit structure in the United States. We have trade and tax policies in our own country that, in fact, support the outsourcing of our jobs. Congressman Rangel, the now chair of Ways and Means, has written some superb articles on this, and it's referenced in our paper. But our tax policies, actually, with the allowable deferrals of offshore profits, accounting rules, tax credits for closing domestic facilities, all, in fact, support the outsourcing of work from the United States to, frankly, cheap labor, to countries where there's cheap labor and no environmental standards and a series of other things that go on within those countries. We have a failure to enforce our own trade law, and that's a fight that we engage in at a national level, in Congress, and with agencies of the federal government. We have laws in place that we don't even enforce in this stuff. There is a failure to address health care as a country. Look, and it costs $1,400 more to build a car in Detroit, Michigan, than it does across the river in Windsor, Ontario. There's something really wrong with that. And the lack of a national health care system in this country is a competitive disadvantage for manufacturing. And it is something that goes on. And again, it is one of those leverage points where the fights in workplaces today are about maintenance of retirement and health care benefits, not even wages. And the public is losing. The public is losing. We no longer grow together as a nation, and you can see this. One of the startling numbers that has really emerged in the last couple of years is that up until about 1980, this country, if you watch the growth of productivity and you watched the growth of wages and compensation, they kind of grew at a relative pace, and that's how we grew the middle class in this country. Since that time, there has been a schism. Productivity continues to shoot up, especially in manufacturing, while compensation has barely gone up. For example, in the last 20 years, productivity in manufacturing increased by 131%. For the non-supervisory workforce, the compensation increased 7%. A huge differential, a huge gap has emerged. And that is kind of the pressures and stress that are being put on the workers of this country, and in turn, our communities, the income, the tax revenues, and everything else that are dependent upon that. The bottom line is it's not just manufacturing workers. And I think this is one thing I'd really, if I can get the committee to understand, is the pressures from this globalization, the nature of the change that's taking place. People tend to think, well, it's just, you know, it's a low-end job. It's blue-collar workers. No, it's not. It's highly skilled blue-collar workers. And, in fact, it's research and development, it's design, it's engineering, it's financial services, it's software. Manufacturing has been a canary in a coal mine for changes that are occurring in the rest of the economy and other sectors of the economy. And the white-collar professional is just as an endangered species in many sectors as the blue-collar workers who have been born the front end of these changes and government policy that, in fact, encourages this stuff. I really want to say that government policy is not just what happens in Washington, D.C. It'll be one of my closing points to you here. So we see us treating this stuff and talking about what do we do about it. Now, when you talk to the free market economists, the orthodoxy says, this is like the weather. It's an act of God. You can't do anything about this. That's absolutely not true. We make the rules under which these things happen, right? We set the rules. We determine how the game is played. Unfortunately, the rules of the game have been determined by the multinational corporations against domestic manufacturers, against small farmers. Tell you a story about that later if you ask a question about farmers. Very, very interesting, something I learned recently. But we see professional and technical workers in the same boat with manufacturing workers. And with the foreign direct investment of the major corporations going to China, going offshore, with the research and development engineering, it means something to us. It means that the loss of all these manufacturing jobs, these skilled workers, this research, the design, the engineering, means that the promise that we have of being the innovative society, right, it means that that next best idea, that next generation of product, that next innovation and that next investment is being made in someone else's economy, not ours. Because the factory floor is the bedrock of innovation, and you move that, you take that link in the chain of the innovation process up. It's like people from Microsoft, I've heard, say, well, we'll keep software architecture and the rest of the world will do the software. What's that? How do you get to software architecture unless you have a firm base of people who actually do the software work at the lower levels? They tie together. They're linked, and so is manufacturing. Can we do something about these things? And I would answer to you, yes, we certainly can. On my testimony, you'll see a set of union principles for economic development, for a high road. And actually, this comes out of the growth of the Oregon experience and other states, as you'll see in the Economic Development Guide. We believe workers here and abroad should have the right to organize and bargain collectively. They will raise their own wages and improve their working conditions. We believe in high and uniform wage standards, and that's why conversations about a minimum wage, and I applaud Oregon for what it's done on its minimum wage, or living wages that you hear about in other communities, or Davis-Bacon, or prevailing wages, are all issues around a high wage system, and it's something that we should want as a state, and raising per capita income should be and was a goal of this state under Oregon Shines in the benchmarks. We believe in full labor participation in economic development and workforce training and development, in engaging the workers in this process. We believe in the development and the modernization and worker-friendly approaches with companies. The manufacturing extension programs, I think, have been an important thing that states have supported as the federal government, or this the Bush administration, has continually tried to withdraw funding, and we've continually fought to put it back in for this. We think it's important. Union and non-union companies, we think it's important to modernize and keep manufacturing on the cutting edge. We believe in public investments that are accountable. There are five things we can do, I believe, as a country, as a national strategy for manufacturing. One is, we call it the pause, review, and renew on how we deal with trade. Stop doing trade deals. We actually come up with a strategy to be competitive as a nation. Review what's going on with those deals and the impact that it's had on states and across the country. And then when we talk about renewing, let's talk about real standards that go in there, including worker rights, including environmental standards, including the development of those countries' own economies, not just export-led strategies, but ways in which those countries can better develop their economies, pay their workers better wages, and become productive in their own self. The second thing we should do is worker rights. Here and abroad, I don't draw a distinction. In fact, the International Human Rights Commission has cited the United States for its failure to enforce worker rights in this country. People don't understand how difficult it is for workers to try and organize a union on their own. That's another subject of a much longer matter, but I just want to make the point. We have as much trouble in this country as happens in other countries, and we fight for worker rights around the world. Structure corporate and tax policy differently. Change the incentive structure from going offshore to keeping domestic manufacturing and investing in domestic manufacturing. When states and federal government invest in other forms of corporate incentives, like R&D, right? I know when I was here with the Economic Development Department, this state, when we made an investment in the state, we always had to figure out, what's the payback? What's the benefit? How will this be attached to jobs? Well, we should be asking the same thing about all R&D investments. And I know some are far, far out research, far from production. Many others are closer to production. And that should be linked to actual domestic production for the research we paid for with those R&D tax credits. We don't do that. It's foolish. We need national health care, simply. And I encourage every state that's doing experimentation, I understand, as former Governor Kitzhaber just made a proposal yesterday, we think states' experimentation is very important and will help move our federal government to actually do something, because we need a national solution, and I believe the state efforts are helping in that direction, and there's some very interesting things. I just heard the contours of the former governor's policy here. The state of Wisconsin is looking at a single-payer pool that can cut the administrative cost 35%. Because the system is so balkanized, and they have employers and unions working together with government on that. A manufacturing investment strategy. If this government is going to invest money at the federal, state, and local level, how can you do it in such a way that it's linked back to a jobs policy? It's like the R&D tax credit idea. But if you're going to invest, and I think energy is a needs, a national need, a state need, a local need. So if you start thinking about energy investment policy, how do you link that, whether it's renewables, or conservation, or energy efficiency building, how is that linked to jobs, both from the construction end, but more importantly, I would argue, for these newer technologies. How do you capture those technologies so that, in fact, we are producing them and can turn around and export them? I mean, one of the problems in solving our trade deficit is you need to make things to solve a trade deficit because you got to have something to trade. And more, we have less to trade because we aren't making these things anymore. It's a real dilemma, and that's why I encourage investment in manufacturing. The other point of this is that follow a needs-based investment strategy, and then I think talk about workforce and the skills of your workforce. And one of the few things we actually have a national strategy in manufacturing is we have national manufacturing skill standards. I was part of a process for 10 years with business and labor to actually design a manufacturing skill standard certification process. A system certifies and can provide training for skills. And this should be linked to whatever Oregon is thinking about in manufacturing. There really is a national system there. And the importance of it is employers can understand the skills they have in the workplace. Workers can get certified for those skills, and that's a transferable certification that you can take someplace else and say, I know this stuff. I can do this. It can help in your employment system as people transfer and have mobility to go between jobs. You should utilize the apprenticeship system. It's often tremendously underutilized. The building trades know how good it is. Certain sectors know how good it is. But industrial apprenticeships have fallen off the map because manufacturing has gone in the tank. And it's a problem. We do have a generational shift and change underway, and they should be revitalized and used. Learning by doing is the best system. Asking the workers, the unions, and employers involved about how to design the training and certify it, it's the best of all worlds. And I think this committee would very much seek and appreciate the collaboration between workers and unions and employers and our educational systems in a better way and a more comprehensive way. Finally, all these comments I've just made about what needs to be done nationally or what we can do have direct local applications. This is about thinking globally and acting locally. The apprenticeships, the worker training system we just talked about is really important. I want to make sure, though, that you don't fall into the trap that these neoconservative economists and people want to tell you, which is, oh, don't worry about that job loss. Don't worry about what's happening over there. Don't worry about what's happening in manufacturing. You know, it's really the fault of the worker. They just need to get smarter. They just need more training and education. I will support training and education to have our workforce have the greatest skills in the world. But you know what? It's like taking your kid out, and you give them swimming lessons, get them all trained up, and they take a shower, and put your suit on and say, now go jump in the pool. And nobody's paid any attention to see that the drains are unplugged and the water's going down. You have to do workforce development in conjunction with economic development and a vision of what's going on in your economy in the state so that you know what you're training for, you're aiming for something, and you want to go someplace. Do not settle for just saying we're going to fix this by workforce training and education. You're only taking a half bite at the apple, and in the end, you may not be training people for what you really need to do, and you may not really be addressing ways in which you could move your economy. And I would argue the things I raised about health insurance and workforce development and investment in energy policy and these kinds of things are doable. They're reachable within a state. And very lastly, I would say, trade is not an issue left to Washington, D.C. God help us, because it has been. And who has had trade deals negotiate the way your sovereignty as representatives of state government and your rights to use procurement policy to address jobs concerns and investment concerns of the state and other things, that trade is not left alone and you have things to say about it. And you can ask for this pause and review of deals. You can talk about don't do the old fast track the way we did. We need standards in it. You can talk about and pass laws around the sovereignty of the state. You, as a legislature, can have a say in any trade deals that this government of this state would sign off on. Trade and what is happening in globalization is too important for you to think it abides in the hands of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative in Washington, D.C. It's a mistake. And this last election was all about people who finally said, we have had enough. We want to change your direction. And I would encourage you in the state of Oregon to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Questions or comments for Mr. Baugh from the committee? Representative Barr?
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, it's sort of like drinking out of a fire hose. We talk about that as our metaphor for what we do in these sessions anyway. And this material is so dense, and you've covered, of course, just the top, very thin layer of it. I wonder if you would mind being a bit more explicit about things this committee and things that the state of Oregon, or the legislature at least, can do to be helpful in, and you pick the area of the ones you've already cited. I mean, you've talked about health care, you've talked about, I don't know that you talk about pension systems, but it seems to me that from an economic point of view, they fall into the same category.
Yes.
Since in many other governments, pensions are paid by the government, and so they're accounted for differently. You've talked about trade laws, and of course I'm familiar with the fact that the supremacy clause and the treaty power of the federal government means that in effect things that are within state sovereignty end up being controlled by our trade laws, our international trade laws. So, I mean, that's a significant issue, and one that I think is an absolutely nonpartisan issue in Oregon. We're opposed to them. Former Representative Krupp and I attended meetings together, and we agree on very little, but we absolutely agreed on that. And so what is it that the state of Oregon can do, or that this committee can do, that will be useful in dealing with the trade imbalance issues and the manufacturing policy that you're describing? And maybe pick an area and be a little more explicit.
I was asked to hit the high spots, and that's absolutely true. I think what is the two things that are very germane to this committee clearly is you're in the area of workforce. I mean, that's one piece of this. But you're also economic development. I think this is a marriage that I am suggesting you really enhance. It is a robust relationship. So I think that some of these issues, I suspect the energy investment policy, the stuff that's going on in Oregon, I don't even know if it's in this committee or where it is. I know there's proposals around renewables and things of that nature that I think would be very important to this committee around economic development. And that is something that is actually happening in legislatures across the country, though I'm not familiar, Representative Barnhart, whether it is germane to this committee.
We're working on it here.
Oh.
Not in this committee particularly, but certainly in this legislature.
Certainly. Well, I think all these issues are, as the health care is maybe another committee. So these are all germane to this. Part of the reason I did all these pieces is to make the point that doing economic development and addressing the needs of manufacturing, there's no silver bullet. Workforce isn't one, but it is the combination of these items that will enhance the ability of manufacturing to survive and thrive. But in particular, of things that appear to be more germane, at least from my limited knowledge of the committee's portfolio, obviously the issues of what are you going to do about workforce, how you use apprenticeship more widely and broadly and renew industrial apprenticeships. I know our union folks are working with Manufacturing 21 around working together as business and labor to address these workforce needs. And I think the idea of promoting the consortium approach to training and education is absolutely critical. It certainly is one of the lessons we learned 20 years ago and tried to do here. If you went to every business, they're going to tell you one at a time, I want this specific thing to be take care of my specific need, and it's not going to cut it. We have to have industry talking to each other so they can collaborate and cooperate with each other along with our educational institutions and the workers and unions that are engaged with them to determine really what the needs are and what are the tools. And I would also encourage you to look at the National Manufacturing Skills Standards as a tool to be used as part of this process. It's there, it's available, it's in writing, it's in book form now. I mean, there's some assets out there that I rather suspect my colleagues that are behind me and in the community colleges are familiar with, because it's the word has gotten around about these, so maybe they do, but I think that's very much germane to this committee. I don't know who addresses the issue of trade in the Oregon legislature. You know, and I suspect, you know, I suspect it's you. This, I mean, originally this used to be the Joint Committee on Trade and Economic Development. Once upon a time there was one like that. I assume you're the successor to that. I think it is important. I just spoke to the National Council of State Legislators meeting in San Antonio a couple weeks ago. And I made this point over and over and over. You have a right. This state has a right to say things about our national and international relations and trade policy. You're affected by it. What was stunning to me was meeting with 40 farmers for 3 days at a retreat of farm organizations that I was asked to, and to find out how incensed they were, how hurt, how much, in particular, smaller and family farms are under the gun, both from the practices of Walmart, from the retail side, and on the international side, from being overwhelmed by the Cargills and ADMs of the world, and other goods and produce coming in from other countries. So, I mean, it's interesting because I think farmers and workers and manufacturers, domestic manufacturers, have a similar analysis, a similar concern. And I think there are things you can stand up and do and say, and I think it's important to lend your voice to this process. We have a Jobs, Trade, and Democracy Act, a model bill that talks about tools and the engagement of the legislature on the sovereignty issue, which I'd be happy to provide the committee with. There's another bill out there on sovereignty. There's a resolution that is being circulated to every state in the country about to tell Congress, if you're going to do fast track, it should look like this. That gets at these standards issues about how to appropriately do trade. And I want to make it absolutely clear. My testimony is not in opposition to trade. We absolutely believe in trade. We believe it's being done wrong, and that the only one whose interests are being addressed is the global corporate investor, the multinationals. But the workers, our states and communities, those companies are representing not a national interest, not a state and local interest, and we've got to be part of this. And so there's that kind of a resolution that could be passed as a sense of your legislature to send to Congress, to make clear to your elected representatives in Congress that you have strong feelings about this and to do the right thing. So I believe those two areas are two that are very germane and that are very doable. And there is model legislation floating around out there within the National Council of State Legislatures and other places that provide some models for you to look at.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Barnhart.
Just a comment on the last bit of what you've said. We have a rule that requires that materials for drafting of bills and resolutions be in our Legislative Council office 10 days from today. So if you have some things you'd like to suggest to us, do it soon.
It will be in the Chair's hands by this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions or comments from our witness, Representative Volpe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your comments. I've kind of share very similar views about our plight with trade and how it's really hamstrung our manufacturing, and it's been one of the things that I believe is held our wages so low that you've described as productivity has skyrocketed and wages have basically remained flat. So, you know, in light of that and thinking that, you know, that's the big issue and the federal government is the one that enters into these trade agreements, and, you know, we're talking about trying to compete fairly on an international level with having requirements for certain standards abroad, yet we have no control over that, those standards abroad. You know, it's sort of perplexing that as a state that we would like to set standards for products that we import, or, you know, so that we can compete fairly. But without being able to do that, you know, it puts so much pressure on our industries and our businesses to be able to, you know, raise wages, which is what I believe we need for a better economy, is, you know, having the working class of America not disappear but be able to participate in our economy. So I'm always looking for ways to address that trade issue, you know, and, you know, I hear what you're saying, that we could pass a resolution and send it to the federal government that, you know, we want standards set around trade, and that would be a good effort, but, you know, just as we have, many states have requirements of fruit and produce that goes across their borders, you know, it seems like, you know, our state should have the ability to set those kind of standards, you know, no matter what border they're, since they're coming across our border, it shouldn't matter where it comes from, because those standards are set to protect the state of Oregon's economy and environment. And so I'm very interested in what you have to say and whether there's legal precedent for states to set standards on products that come in and have them stand up against the federal government and I guess the World Trade Organization to some effect, because we're sort of obligated to go along with them under current administration policy. So, I mean, do you see us having little niches where we can actually have an effect on the products that are coming into this state and have them stand up?
I think there are ways you can have an impact on it. I don't believe that a single state's going to dictate the standards on the products that are coming in, but I think we got to have a voice on at two levels. One, this issue of sovereignty and what is signed off in trade deals. In fact, they asked the states, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative asked the states to sign off on this stuff that gives up your certain sovereign rights as a state around your procurement policies and how you spend your own money. You don't have to do that. That is troubling. That creates trouble. I think you need to send a message, and you have the right to do that. That the state of Oregon says, if you said, we're going to have a procurement policy that is directed towards buying towards Oregon or buying American, and giving certain concessions around that, you have the right to do that. And you don't, you know, you can tell the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, we're not going to let you sign away our rights to do this, to determine how we spend our taxpayers' dollars in support of manufacturing in our state or our country. So there's a step you can take there. I think that one of the things that we've seen a couple states do, and it's in that actually model legislation, Pennsylvania has formed an office of, I'm trying to think of the correct name of it, but essentially it's a trade office. And not as we've met it here in the past, which is to send people over and set up offices in China and Japan, but in fact it's a trade office designed to help domestic manufacturers and to be able to investigate trade violations and help them actually file a case against the federal government or in violation of trade law. You know, lots of little employers, smaller firms, don't have the technical, the legal, nor the financial capacity to do this on their own. They can be very complicated. But we're trying to find ways to make it less complicated, to bring, and you could have it as an organizer that brings firms together to do this. But in a way, you're providing technical assistance to help people who, in and of their own right, might not be able to do it. And again, Oregon having a face and a voice in place to assist employers and workers in raising and fighting for these issues. I mean, you can do that, and the state of Pennsylvania has done that, and we're encouraging others to look at that. The state of Maine has a committee that investigates closures. I mean, one of the most awful things out there is we don't understand what's happened here. Yeah. If you talk to the conservative economists, they'll tell you, trade just plays a little role in what's going on. We went back and investigated 2 years ago. We took a look at five states. Minnesota, Washington, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Who else? There's another one. And went and looked at all the WARN notices. Those are the ones that you got to give for firms that you're laying people off. And looked at the TAA. We went back and actually researched all the WARN notices and researched the firms and find out why they really laid people off. We found that in Ohio, over 50% of the closures and job loss were directly related to trade. In Pennsylvania, it was 60%, or in Washington today, it was 80%. That was primarily Boeing. You take Boeing out of the picture, it was still over 60%. So you have to blow up the myth of what's happened. And if you have an office and the Economic Development Department is required to investigate and report as to what exactly has gone on here, so you better understand your economy and the ways that are affecting it. It also can help you from the strategic side about other ways we can help address this. There were many more tools a dozen years ago available to the state that don't exist anymore, but they worked at the time.
Other questions and comments from the committee? Bob, I have one. I think if we were going to begin development right now of a healthcare delivery system, I remain unconvinced that we would deliver it as a workplace mandate. The $1,400 per automobile that you mentioned in your testimony, I don't think would make rational economic or financial sense to anyone. That is certainly a burden that we place on our employers. I think, as you indicated, it's a competitive disadvantage. There are a lot of countries with whom we compete globally whose employers are not saddled with those kinds of costs. By the same token, employees cannot afford to go uninsured health-wise in this country or anyplace else, particularly given the cost of health care and the rapid inflation rate in that sector. My question to you is, and probably a hard one, is it time to de-link the delivery of health care in our country from an employment-based delivery system?
I think it's time we have a national health insurance system, period, however we get there. And maybe it's linked, maybe it's not. But I think everybody deserves it. I mean, in the last couple of years, the last 4 or 5 years, more than there was an increase of the uninsured by 5 million. And I can guarantee you the single direct cause to that was the decline of 3 million manufacturing jobs, because this was a sector that as a whole, more than any other sector, provided health care through an employer-based system. We have another 50 million people in this country who are absolutely underinsured, and it's a disgrace for the richest nation in the world to have people going without or going underinsured. So I think we have to take a look at this. I think what Wisconsin is doing is kind of interesting. Their analysis has been, and the state AFL-CIO did it first, they looked and said, how can we get health insurance to more people, and looked at the employer side of this. And when they looked, they realized, and they did a big study and said, you know, 35% of the costs are bound up in a balkanized system with so many multiple insurers, with so many different things, and that we eat up 35% or more of the actual dollars that go into the system just in overhead, just in the administration of this, because of the balkanized system. And they went to the employers, and the employers said, we don't believe you. And they put their actuaries on it and did their own study and came back and said, these guys are right. So they are looking at a pooled system that would change the nature of the role of the private insurers, a single-payer system that will be able to provide much wider spread coverage. Is it time to de-link? Maybe. I don't really care. I think the issue is, how do we get the best health care to everybody? And there's nothing to be said that, you know, in collective bargaining relationships, that you can't negotiate supplemental benefits above and beyond a standard of which you're applying to the entire population. They do that in Europe. It's doable.
Thank you very much.
Actually, I have one quick
please,
question.
Please, Representative Torres.
And it's totally off of anything that you've touched on, but it has to do with, I'd like to hear your opinion about the immigration question.
Very interesting question, and actually is a trade question.
It is.
And one of the this is the way I would answer it, because I'm not going to get into the issue of fences, and you know, I will give you one thing. I believe that people who are here and working hard should have a path to citizenship. Beyond that, what is the nature of the mass migration out of Mexico? Go read NAFTA, I would tell you. We drove 2 million farmers off of subsistence living off the land as the Cargills and ADMs moved in with mass farming and subsidized corn from the United States. And where did they go? They tried to go to the Malcadoras, and they couldn't get the jobs at the border's edge. They cross it. I mean, we have created our own monster here in many ways. All the promises that came from that said this will curate jobs in Mexico, absorb the population, none of this stuff came true. We lost jobs here and created mass, you know, intensified immigration, illegal immigration into the United States as a result of that. What do I think we should do? I think we should go back and relook at NAFTA. And the failure we have here, let me make something clear about how we can think about doing trade in a very different way. And I would make two points when I say this. One, we should have had an investment side policy with the Mexican and Canadian governments around this to invest in Mexico, to raise their standards up, to give people more skills, to create a stronger domestic economy, which means investment directed towards developing an economy in Mexico that will consume the goods they make, not an export-led platform strategy, which is what we did. Why did we do that? That's what our multinationals wanted to do. They didn't give a damn about what was going on with Mexican workers. So I would argue that. And people who say, well, you can't do this, let me tell you. Let me give two big examples from history where we did it right. At the end of the Second World War, we sat down to negotiate with the losers. We imposed certain standards. One of them was the right to organize and bargain collectively within your societies. It was built in their constitutions. Why did our government do that? Well, they felt, A, they wanted to create another institutional presence so you could change the nature of, create a democracy and have another institutional presence there. But it certainly succeeded in Japan, Germany, Italy, and all the other countries that were the losers over the next 50 years of creating a vibrant middle class and growing manufacturing and industrial economy. So much so, we ended up in the soup in the 80s as we started to compete with them. It's been done before, and it works. When Europe expanded the common market, for the Economic Development Department, we went and did a study about the learning systems and about workforce systems related to the economy and published a report that was used here around what we tried to do in school reform. When we were there, the conversation was, if we're going to let in Greece, Portugal, and Spain, which were more like developing countries than Germany, France, and Italy, how do we do this in a way that raises their standards over time and doesn't bring down ours around our environment, around safety and health, around wages and benefits? And they said, we invest in the workforce, we invest in our economy, we do it over time. And you know what? Spain and Portugal and Greece are success stories. They did it. It worked. They're not quite doing it the same way as they've incorporated much of Eastern Europe, a much bigger fish to swallow. But I think the answer is there are different ways to do this, that as we do trade, we have to think about how do you really develop those domestic economies so, in fact, they can become consumers. And the bottom line from our point of view is, and it's Keynesian economics, if you give workers the right to bargain and organize, they will raise their wages and improve their working conditions. And you don't have to wait for government to help make it happen. But in fact, government plays the third-party role that sets up a legal structure and says people can do this and will do this, and we will recognize that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a follow-up on the last question. It sounds like what you're saying is that NAFTA actually caused the migration of so many South Americans into the United States, or Latin Americans into the United States, because of the destabilization of the farm economy in Mexico. Is that what you're saying? Because of the importation of American grain?
Partly, yes. It's certainly, I'm not going to say that all the immigration that's happened is that's the only cause, but it has been a causal factor. And you can go to the Economic Policy Institute website for their latest reports. They've got a new one coming out about 10 years, 14 years after and after what has happened. And there's been a whole lot of things that have looked at this, that we set up a deal with Mexico, and then their economy fell apart and their dollar was devalued. They found that the subsistence farms, as corporate farming moved in from the United States, knocked people off the land. A lot of international reports out there about how that led to the migration of people off the farms to the cities. Nothing there for them. Where do you go? The sun's shining up north, and there's more opportunity there than there. And these people just wanted what every other American worker wants. They want a roof over their head. They want to feed their families. They want to have a decent life. They want to get their kids to school. I mean, what would you do? I mean, so I think we have to step back and say, when we are, our economic interests are only represented by the global corporate investor, that financial community, that we overlook these other human rights and these social contracts that people have worked so hard for, and thinking more clearly about what is the investment side of this policy that will improve their economy so that, in fact, they can work there and live in their own country and develop that and be citizens much like the ones they're trying to emulate to the north.
follow-up question.
Yes, Representative Gerard.
But doesn't this, the immigration question that we're addressing, doesn't that undermine your ability to collectively bargain? It just seems, in visiting various steel unions, they were quite concerned that that was the outcome.
In the greater context of things, I would say, in essence, what has happened with Mexico is they've exported their unemployment to the United States. And certainly that would have an effect on the ability to retain and raise wages here. I mean, in fact, our argument is that those workers are scared to death. They can't join a union. They're afraid to join a union because the employers turn them into INS. I mean, it's a vicious circle out there about how it works in the real world. So I think that, that both this issue of globalization, which I say is not just trade, it does embrace the issues of immigration, has had an impact that serves as a wedge in the ability of domestic workers to raise their wages and benefits. Yes, it is a problem. It's part of the bigger picture. That's why we say we have to think differently about how we do trade. The pressure would be less there if, in fact, that migration had not occurred and people were able to develop and do better in their own economies as well. There's another piece of that too. Let me make a final point on this. We have other forms of immigration with H-1B, H-2B visas, the whole visa scheme out there. We have the American Hospital Association coming in claiming there's a consistent shortage of nurses, so we need to import nurses. 118,000, they said last year, we have a chronic shortage of 118,000 nurses yearly. So they get a huge ability to import nurses. And where do they get them from? Third world developing nations. The Philippines has been drained of their nurse population. They're training nurses to send to America, and their healthcare systems are suffering as a result. We had 150,000 qualified applicants in the United States to enter nursing schools and couldn't get in because there weren't places for them. That's a domestic investment policy.
Yeah. With that, Bob, thank you so very, very much for your excellent, insightful, and even provocative testimony. It was greatly appreciated, and I think you've made some suggestions that our committee will be well-served to consider. And a special thanks for your willingness to travel all the way from Washington, D.C. to be here this morning. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. As I said at the beginning, it's an honor to appear in front of this committee. It feels pretty special being back in this building again.
Welcome back to Oregon. Before we proceed with the next panel, perspectives on economic growth, just for the record, I'd like to recognize that Representative Dahlem is out ill today and probably won't be able to join us here. I'm going to ask our next panels, because we're going to try and wrap this up promptly at 10 a.m., if folks could try and limit their testimony to 5 or 10 minutes. I think all of you have seen that we are a very eager committee here, and if you only touch on the highlights, that's fine, because I guarantee you this committee is going to ask questions to get at the roots of some things. So with that, I'd like to invite up a panel. Impressa Incorporated, Joe Courtwright, Oregon Center for Public Policy, Mike Leachman, and the Institute for a Sustainable Environment with Cassandra Mosley. If you please all come forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
While they're coming forward, I'm really struck by the last bit of testimony from our previous witness. It reminds me of the Industrial Revolution in England 180 years ago, when peasants were being forced off of the farmland and moving to the cities and living really very poorly. Anybody who's read Dickens knows those stories. And the interesting point of it was, of course, that led to the Industrial Revolution because labor became available. It sounds as though what your witness was saying is that the problem in Mexico is that there is no, the development of the economic system in the Mexican cities and the urban areas and the industrial sector is not happening. And that's why we have this huge surplus of labor in Mexico. That was a point I hadn't been aware of before, and I think it's very interesting for us to know about that.
Well, and I think Representative Barnhart, economics would suggest that whenever there is an imbalance in the economic system, there is a tendency towards balance, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And people are making what in their own individual instances are rational economic choices based on that proclivity to seek balance. Anyone else?
I like it.
With that, please, welcome this morning. Thank you all so very much for coming. And welcome. We are ready once again for another panel. We look forward to what you have to tell us. And please, for the record, introduce yourselves.
I'm Joe Courtright. I'm an economist with Impresa in Portland, Oregon.
I'm Mike Leachman. I'm the senior policy analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy.
I'm Cassandra Mosley. I direct the Ecosystem Workforce Program in the Institute for Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon.
Well, thank you. A very impressive panel for certain. I don't know if you've decided who's going to go first, but before each of you speaks, if you would, just for the purposes of the public record, identify yourselves again before you begin your comments. With that, please.
You're the first one.
I guess by default it falls to me. For the record, Joe Courtright, I'm an economist again with Impresa in Portland, Oregon, and like Bob Baugh, this is old home week for me. I had the honor of serving the Oregon Legislature as your committee administrator for 12 years. It's good to see Representative Lim once again. I had the opportunity to work with him, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I don't have any formal prepared remarks. I just have a couple of points that I'd like to make. Before I do that, just one observation. I would just, what my firm does is advise state and local governments all over the United States about how to respond to the changes of the kind of economy that we find ourselves living in today. And fundamentally, I think we're in a very different kind of economy than we were 10 or 20 years ago. And as states and localities, much as we'd like to change, and we will try to change the global ground rules that we all have to compete under, we also have to devise strategies for dealing with the situation that we find ourselves in today. And I think one of the fundamental changes that we have to realize, and the committee's been wrestling with this, is that the nature of the economy has changed from what it was 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and even 20 years ago. And I would just suggest that the economy is not simply about making things anymore. Making things is important, but it's about making things better and making better things. And so the key to success in that kind of economy is ideas. We're in an economy that rewards knowledge. It rewards workers with good knowledge and skills and who innovate, and it rewards firms that innovate and have knowledge, and it rewards communities and places that have knowledge and that innovate. So the key to economic success for workers, for businesses, for places, is how you build up the knowledge base and the innovative capacity of your community so that you can make better things and make things better. That's how you outcompete other places, how you raise your standard of living. And that's fundamental. So with that as just sort of a preamble, let me suggest there are four things that states like Oregon have to do to be successful. And they are talent, innovation, clusters, and distinctiveness. And I'll explain what I mean by each of those. The first one is talent. It's become increasingly clear that economic success depends on the level of skills and education that workers have. We, as economists, we measure something called the skill premium, which is basically how much more you get paid in the economy based on how much more education you have. And over the last 25 years or so, the skill premium in the United States has roughly doubled. That is, one way of measuring it is how much more does a college graduate make than somebody with just a high school education. That's gone from about a 30 to 40% premium 20, 25 years ago to about almost an 80% premium today. And that's just an indicator of an economy that rewards people for what they know. That's an easy way to measure it, but we have a lot of indications that that's true. And what's true for individual workers is also true for places. places that have well-educated workforces, highly skilled workforces, have higher levels of income than places that don't. Statistically, we can explain about 60% of the variation in per capita income between states simply by knowing how well-educated their population is. So that's critical. And the other thing I'd say is, in this economy of ideas and of knowledge, the notion that you get educated, say, in the first 20 years of your life and then just simply work thereafter is simply outmoded. That what we have to move towards is a system that provides people with continuous opportunities to acquire skills and to learn and to become more productive over their entire lives. And I think, in a way, we've inherited an education system that was designed for a fundamentally different economy than we have today. And part of our challenge is to design a new kind of education system that is better aligned with the kind of economic competition that our people and workers are in, that our companies are in. So talent is the first issue. It's a big one. The second one is innovation. You know, smart people are the key to producing the new ideas that help all businesses be successful. Now, I know there's a tendency to kind of identify innovation with, say, the high-tech industry. But I want to suggest to you, and I've done a lot of work with the Oregon Business Plan over the last 4 or 5 years, is that innovation is critical to the success of every business in this state. Whether you're talking about farmers and food processors, whether you're talking about people in forestry and the wood products industry, whether you're talking about the metals industry, basically anybody who runs their business and does what they did 20 years ago and is doing that same thing today is getting killed. The businesses that are successful are the ones who are developing better processes, developing new products, being more innovative. And we actually see really good examples of growth and success in the traditional sectors of the Oregon economy where people are innovative, and then also the newer sectors as well. So that's really key. But one of the things I would suggest is that take it a step further, which is the state government and the public sector sets the environment for innovation. And having Oregon be a state that is a cutting-edge state, that is addressing difficult problems like healthcare, like environment, like labor relations, the more we can be innovative at the state level, that sets, and in the public sector, that sets an environment for innovation in the private sector as well. So it's not just about what people do in their businesses and their workplace. It's whether you have a community that values and appreciates innovation and moves into the future. Third point is clusters. And I know Representative Lim has had to endure my talk on clusters any number of times. So at least for his sake, I'll be brief. But the notion of clusters is that if you look at the Oregon economy and look carefully at the structure of the Oregon economy, it is not a random set of businesses. We are very, very good in certain things in Oregon. That's actually true everywhere. Economies tend to specialize in certain things. And in Oregon, we have a mix of the traditional resource-based industries, the ones that are sort of woven into the carpets of the House and Senate chambers, forestry, fisheries, agriculture. And then we also have a distinctive set of industries in the knowledge-based sectors of the economy. We're very strong in semiconductors and display technology, in sporting goods and apparel, in a variety of recreation-related industries, and so on. The key point here is that if you're thinking about how you want to influence the economy of Oregon, you have to work with and through the set of industry clusters that we have. Now, Bob Baugh made a very good suggestion in his testimony that one of the keys to success here is getting workers and employers and the government to all collaborate to deal with key issues like job training. What I would argue is that the way to structure those collaborations is cluster by cluster. Get groups of businesses and workers together in these industry clusters where there's a common relationship, where there's a common set of markets, where there's a common set of skill needs, because they have a really coherent basis for collaboration. And so as you go forward, and we have a lot of good examples now of this from communities around the state, use this idea of industry clusters as the central organizing principle for planning and delivering workforce and economic development services. So as you look at the Oregon Economic Development Department, if you look at education programs, if you look at workforce programs, what you should do is think about how you organize those programs to work with the clusters that really are the big drivers for the Oregon economy. And the more we can work with groups of firms and workers to solve their problems, as opposed to working with the world one company at a time, the more likely we are to have economic success. Final point, and I apologize to my other panelists, too, if I'm going a bit long, but I'll just wrap this up quickly, is distinctiveness is critically important. It's a big global economy out there. We will not be the best in everything, but we can be the very best in some things. And the key to economic strategy, and if you heard Michael Porter at the Oregon Business Council's summit meeting last year, he said the key to success is to have a what the business people call a unique value proposition. What is it about your state, about your place, that makes it different and better than any other place for the particular things that you do? And that's, I think, the challenge to Oregon going forward, is to not to try and make Oregon more like other places. That's not an economic strategy. It's not an economic strategy for winning. Making Oregon the very best Oregon that it can be is critically important. And strikingly, coming out of the business community, you know, we worked with the Oregon Business Plan, and they said, you know, this is asking a group of business leaders, what is it that makes Oregon distinctive from other places? And the theme that they identified was sustainability. So this is not a group of, you know, Earth First Green Party radicals. This is a group of very, you know, middle-of-the-road business people saying sustainability is Oregon's real strength. We're really recognized for it globally. We have a lot of businesses that are really pushing the envelope there, and we know there's huge opportunity going forward to grow the economy based on that. So focus on building that distinctiveness as opposed to, you know, pursuing the fad of the day. Oregon will do better if it is true to its strengths. So the four keys that I would argue that you pay attention to: building the talent base of the state, creating an environment for innovation and for new ideas, organizing your program by industry clusters and working to assure the success of those clusters, and then building on Oregon's distinctiveness. Those four things are really the keys to a successful economy for the future. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you very much, and welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Pike. I think so.
Okay. Yes.
Going on the list on the agenda. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name again for the record is Mike Leachman. I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for inviting me. The Oregon Center for Public Policy, as some of you probably know, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research center. We focus on both improving decision making and also on promoting opportunities for all Oregonians. We, once every 2 years, produce a resource guide. It's released usually around Labor Day. The latest one is called Who's Getting Ahead? Opportunity in a Growing Economy. Copies were distributed to your boxes last week, and I've asked the committee staff to provide you each with copies this morning. We have found in our research and in preparing that report that it's, you know, it's quite clear, and it's and the more recent data shows this too, it's quite clear that Oregon's economy has grown at a solid pace the last few years. We've added 150,000 jobs since the middle of 2003. Our job growth since then ranks ninth fastest in the country. We've seen our exports up just this past year, up 25%, which is significantly faster than national export growth of 15% last year. Our share of U.S. gross domestic product is high by historical standards, even as high as it was in the late 1990s during the boom years. It's true that our unemployment rate remains higher than the national rate, and sometimes it seems like this is the only statistic that we hear about. I think and I want to just mention that because, you know, it's a good example of an isolated economic statistic that sometimes gets misused to mischaracterize what's happening in the economy. As we talk about in Who's Getting Ahead, and as the Employment Department has detailed, our unemployment rate is typically higher than the national rate, has not much to do with the health of our economy. We've had a higher unemployment rate than the national unemployment rate in all of but five of the last 34 years. And we've never had a lower unemployment rate than the national rate any time in the last 10 years, including during the late 1990s. The reasons are basic structural reasons in our economy, and also because we've just seen a lot of population growth. People are moving here, which is not a bad thing. We also tend to depend on seasonal jobs more than other states, and we have communities that are more geographically isolated than most communities in other states. Those factors lead us to a typically higher unemployment rate. It offers little reason to fret about the health of our economy. It maybe should spur us to think about how to restructure our unemployment insurance system so that it better matches what the unemployment levels that we can typically expect in the economy. But the main story about growth in our economy in Oregon is that while we've seen solid growth the last few years, most Oregonians aren't benefiting much from that growth. The wages are stagnant for most workers. Healthcare costs are up. Fewer of working age Oregonians even have health care coverage at all. We've shown how the highest income Oregonians are really reaping a highly disproportionate share of the benefits of economic growth, and that this follows a pattern from the last two periods of economic growth in the 90s and in the 80s as well. And in the meantime, the cost of getting ahead is rising, so it's become less affordable just in the last few years for Oregonians to go to college, to buy a home, even to pay for child care while they work. Relative to overall price increases, the costs of doing those things all of those things have gotten less affordable. It's gotten more difficult to get ahead. And so it's no wonder that we've seen an explosion in debt problems just in the last few years here in Oregon. So, you know, it's clear from that work that Oregon's economic development strategy really has to be about more than just growing Oregon's economy. We think that we do that pretty well. You know, I think it's important to keep thinking about, and Joe's ideas I certainly respect and agree with. But economic growth by itself is necessary but not sufficient. We really ought to be focused in our economic development strategy explicitly and centrally about protecting and promoting opportunities for all Oregonians. We think that this sort of approach would be good for Oregon families, obviously, but also for our overall economic health, because when opportunities are widely available, the economy is able to fire on all cylinders. Our research has also shown that's my second main point. That the third thing I wanted to make sure and address is that our research shows that state and local business taxes have declined substantially over the last 20 to 30 years. We've found that as a share of the economy, Oregon's corporate income taxes are down 71% since the late 1970s. The Council on State Taxation, which is a big business group, ranks Oregon 48th lowest for business taxes as a share of private sector economic activity. That finding supported by the other serious studies that have been done. So Oregon's not going to improve its competitive standing by further reducing taxes for corporations operating here, especially when reducing corporate taxes further comes at the expense of investing in the basic public infrastructure that supports private investment in the long term. State and local tax breaks are overrated as economic development tools anyway, since state and local taxes account for less than 1% of the cost of doing business. If we're focusing there, we're trying to influence business investment decisions based on really a minor factor in business investment decisions. We really ought to be focused on developing, maintaining, building the basic public infrastructure, our education system, our transportation networks, training programs, even our parks and other public amenities. My fourth and final point is that Oregon needs some new evaluation tools to more comprehensively and efficiently evaluate how we go about doing economic development. So we have, we suggest six new tools. The first is that we ought to be producing a unified economic development budget. So this would be a biennial report, and it would pull together in one place all of our economic development spending. As you know, we currently, some spending happens through the Economic and Community Development Department. Other state agencies also spend money in ways that promote economic development. We also spend money through the tax system, through tax expenditures in support of economic development. This unified economic development budget would pull together in one place all of that spending and list project would list in the case of tax breaks how much spending how much tax expenditure is associated with each one of those breaks. It would list the name of each corporate taxpayer that was utilizing that tax expenditure, within some limit, say as long as it was worth more than $5,000 or $10,000. And it would include line item budget information for each state agency that's involved in economic development. The second tool is that we ought to centralize the information that that we have about property tax breaks, so that each property taxing entity in the state would be required to submit an annual report to say the Department of Revenue that would list recipients of property tax breaks in their jurisdiction, the value of the break received, and then the state, say if it was the Department of Revenue, would organize the information into a searchable database that would be available to the public on the web. The third thing is that Oregon should produce a standardized application for recipients of all of development subsidies, so that we, for all of the economic development subsidies that we provide, would have information, for example, on the number of workers that the applicant employs at the project site, the share of the jobs that are full-time and part-time, the health care benefits that are provided, and also on the promises or the goals that that the company is setting for itself in getting the subsidy at that project site. The fourth tool is that annual progress reports from each state agency that's involved in economic development subsidies. So each state agency would submit this annual progress report to one agency, probably Economic and Community Development, and it would list details about each subsidized project, the development goals that each applicant established, and their actual performance in reaching those goals. Fifth, we should have a clear set of standards for economic development subsidies. We think that recipients of tax subsidies should be required to meet their development goals within 2 years of getting the subsidy. We also think that recipients should be required to maintain at least 90% of their job base over the 5 years, their job base in Oregon, over the 5 years after receiving an economic development subsidy. We think that no development subsidy should be allowed at all that costs taxpayers more than $35,000 a job. And we think that subsidies shouldn't be awarded to projects where the median wage at the project is significantly lower than the median wage in the project area. Finally, subsidy agreements should provide that Oregon will recapture subsidies if the subsidy recipient doesn't fulfill the project goals. The last tool for evaluation that we think would help improve our economic development efforts is every 2 years, or, you know, 2 years after each subsidy recipient receives the subsidy, the agency that granted the subsidy should produce a progress report that just indicates whether the what the project goals were and whether the applicant has met them. And again, the information from those reports should be compiled and made available to the public on the web. We think that these set of evaluation tools would really improve our ability to monitor the performance of our economic development spending and hold subsidy recipients accountable. So that's all I have. I appreciate the chance to speak with you. Thank you again for the privilege. Happy to work with you over the rest of the session.
Thank you very much, Mike. Process of elimination. Cassandra, you must be up next.
Yes. Again, I'm Cassandra Mosley, Director of the Ecosystem Workforce Program in the Institute for Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today. Just a little bit of background that ISE, the Institute for Sustainable Environment, is an interdisciplinary applied research and community assistance institute at the University of Oregon. The institute has four major programs: the Ecosystem Workforce Program, Resource Innovations, the ISE Lab, and the Climate Leadership Initiative. Through applied research and policy education, the Ecosystem Workforce Program, the program that I'm involved with, seeks to build linkages between ecological health, economic well-being, and democratic governance. Over the past decade, we have worked to support community-based forestry efforts to create economic opportunities, restoring and maintaining forests and watersheds, particularly here in Oregon. As I understand it, I was asked to speak today to provide some thoughts about how Oregon can foster sustainable development. Undoubtedly, there are limitless opportunities to integrate social, ecological, and economic sustainability here in Oregon. I agree with our earlier speaker that sustainability is one of our sectors, although it crosses every industry, every part of the state. It's our innovation. But today I want to just talk about two areas: sustainable rural development and climate change. First, let me turn to sustainable rural development. We all know that Oregon has seen huge economic change over the last 15 to 20 years, and rural Oregon has often borne the brunt of this change. Although some communities have seen growth from retirement, migration, and tourism, much of that growth is probably unsustainable in the medium and long term for a lot of different reasons. And moreover, many rural communities face the decline of family wage jobs, increasing income inequality, food insecurity, and disinvestment in business infrastructure and human capital, and degraded landscapes. In this context, I would argue that we need to consider at least four major concepts or principles when thinking about sustainable rural development. They're reinvestment, integration, scale, and equity. First, reinvestment. With the decline of rural manufacturing, the departure of Forest Service personnel from rural communities, the decline in funding for rural schools and hospitals, and unsustainable resource extraction, we have seen massive disinvestment in Oregon's rural areas. We need to reinvest in many different ways in our rural communities. We need investments in the nonprofit sector, in rural business capacity and workforce, in schools, and in the rural landscape. Second, integration. Sustainability depends fundamentally on integration, many different kinds of integration, and I'm just going to talk about two. First, and most basically, effective sustainable development strategies need to simultaneously improve ecological, social, and economic well-being, not just one of these. Secondly, sustainable economic development strategies cannot be only about workforce development, only about market development, or only about business development. Innovators attempting to develop cutting-edge sectors of businesses often lacked a trained workforce, business readiness, and well-developed markets. We've seen this in the biomass utilization efforts. We see this in the forest certification. We've seen this in organic agriculture, and we've seen some really fascinating ways of overcoming all of these three things simultaneously. In addition, there are often barriers and disincentives in the form of tax policies and regulation, which are unintended consequences of policies created for different purposes at different times. And supporting innovation requires a multifaceted approach. The third major principle or idea I want to talk about is scale. Businesses need to be appropriately scaled for the communities and landscapes in which they are located. Appropriately scaled businesses contribute to economic diversification for communities rather than creating dependency. Appropriately scaled businesses allow for local ownership and capital accumulation. Appropriately scaled businesses make modest and sustainable use of local natural resources. And appropriately scaled businesses do not place enormous demands on limited rural infrastructure. The creation and retention of businesses that are quite small can have significant impacts on the well-being of rural communities. A major coup of a new business in Portland and a new business in Lakeview is a completely different kind of business. Fourth and finally, equity. Over the last two decades, Oregon has seen an increasing gulf between urban and rural and between rich and poor. Oregon's well-being depends on bridging these gaps. Investing in the redevelopment of rural Oregon is an essential step, and as we think about reinvestment in rural Oregon, I would encourage us to take a quality jobs approach, not just an any jobs approach. Let me turn now to the second issue I want to talk about, which is climate change. In doing so, I want to provide a little bit of a caveat. I'm no climate change expert. My colleagues, other colleagues in the ISE are, and we decided we would talk about climate change even though this is not my life's work. But I think we have some things to offer up that are worthy of consideration by this committee. I think arguably climate change is one of the most important issues of our time. The scientific evidence that human-caused climate change is underway is overwhelming. Oregon's communities, businesses, governments, and workers will need to plan for the inevitable shift in our climate and take action to prevent additional climate change. I was going to say that it's also increasingly clear that federal legislation is probably inevitable and that there's an opportunity for Oregon to get out ahead. And on my drive from Eugene this morning, I was listening to NPR, and Nancy Pelosi has said that she wants to pass climate legislation before the July 4th recess. I think that there is already at least two climate change pieces of legislation in the hopper in the Senate side. So I think federal climate change is inevitable, and legislation is inevitable and coming soon. For many sectors of the economy, this adjustment will undoubtedly be extremely difficult. This is particularly true for carbon-intensive industries. At the same time, the need to adapt to and mitigate for climate change presents an enormous opportunity for Oregon to build on this base of sustainability. Climate change creates an impetus to develop and sell to new technologies, create new businesses and employment opportunities, and maybe we might even see whole new sectors emerge. And it creates the opportunity to think about saving money by reducing waste and reducing energy consumption. I would like to pose four questions that I think we should be thinking about as we begin to incorporate climate considerations into our economic development policy in this state. First, what businesses and sectors in our state are particularly vulnerable to climate risk? By climate risk, I'm thinking about regulatory, physical, litigation, competitiveness, and reputational risk. How can we help climate-intensive industries retool their carbon to reduce their carbon emissions? Third, how can we encourage the development of low carbon intensive industries? Fourth, how will we need to shift our public infrastructure, our land use practices, our water management to adapt to changing climatic conditions and to reduce carbon emissions? So I've not exactly painted a picture of an easy future, but I'd just like to conclude by saying that even though Oregon faces some significant challenges for sustainable development, I think it also has enormous advantages compared to many other states. We've been thinking about sustainability in a lot of different sectors and a lot of different communities, and I think that because of that, we have an opportunity which we can build on and move forward. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much, Cassandra. And while the picture that you painted may not be easy, no one said it would be, I think each and every one of you in the panel here has painted a landscape. You've charted the course for us as a committee, some of the very specific things that we as a committee need to be considering and, in fact, doing to further economic and workforce development in this state. Thank you so very, very much for your comments. I have just a few minutes, committee members, for questions here. Out of consideration and courtesy for our next panel, it will be quick here. Anyone with questions or comments at this point from this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Lim, please.
Thank you. Mr. Joe Courtright, glad to have you with us again. And he has been the administrator of the Trade and Economic Committee of the Joint House and Senate together. We should have a joint committee instead of a separate committee with the Senate. Anyway, my question is a cluster issue, such as a mega company, Fortune 500 companies. They have their own tools. They have their own R&D. They have everything they need. Why should they cooperate with the other smaller size of company to work with?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lim, one of the things that we're seeing as a trend in the very largest companies in the world, largest and most technologically sophisticated companies, is a trend towards open innovation. The old model used to be you had your own internal research and development, you patented every idea you came up with, you held very closely onto it. And what companies have discovered really, I think, in the last 10 years is that's a model that makes it really hard to get your ideas embraced by, adopted by other people, and have them build the kind of complementary ideas and investments that make your ideas more valuable. And if you look at some of the largest companies in the world, the IBMs, the Intels, which is Oregon's largest private employer, they're moving more to a model of open innovation where they want to connect with other people who have similar and related sets of knowledge and to do things that build on their knowledge base. So the interesting thing is we're now in an environment where companies are thinking about how they relate more to other people with similar ideas down to very, very small companies. And you know, the model that we've seen with Linux and the open software development model is a model that is now beginning to be the model. A lot of other innovation is being done in our society.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Panel, thank you so very, very much. That was absolutely wonderful testimony. Cassandra, if you have an opportunity, if you could shoot us a hard copy of your testimony,
I'd love
to have that, and we'll share that here with the committee. Again, thank you so very much for your very insightful comments and recommendations. Appreciate your coming today. Our last and final panel today, dealing with the topic of workforce strategies, will include Norm Etter from Manufacturing 21 and Agnes Balassa from Oregon Workforce Partnership. Would you please come forward? Welcome to both of you this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for your willingness to come and share your thoughts with our committee. Please please proceed, and if you would, identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Agnes Balassa with the Enterprise for Employment and Education representing the Oregon Workforce Partnership today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Norm Etter, representing Manufacturing 21 Coalition.
Welcome.
I'm going to let my colleague Agnes precede me.
All right.
Thank you.
By the way, Ray Warden would like to apologize for not being here today as originally planned. He's out with the flu, so I'm pinch hitting today. We had planned to do a PowerPoint, but in the interest of time, we're going to shorten this up quite a bit so you have some time for questions and answers. The reason we're here today is because you are facing a workforce crisis. Oregon is facing a workforce crisis. And all of the good work around economic development will come to nothing unless we can also address this workforce crisis at the same time. The two are critically interlinked, and you can't separate them out and look at them as separate pieces anymore. The crisis is not just cyclical. It's structural. It's not just about not having the right number of people for the jobs that are available, although that's part of it. It's also about a skills gap. It's also about rapidly increasing innovation and technology, which is compounded by the fact that you've got a skills gap. And so this is a long-term issue that needs to be addressed. This was the first downturn in the economy where you had high unemployment rates, and yet companies were still looking for the right individuals to fill the jobs they had. I'm going to take just a minute to talk a little bit about local workforce investment boards, because we are, in many ways, Oregon's best-kept secret. We are private-public partnerships, and we see ourselves as investors, keepers of the public trust, because a lot of what we do is to take public dollars that come to us and then work with the publicly funded systems to try to continually find efficiencies, to find to reduce duplications, and to figure out what's most effective that we can invest in the area of workforce development. And so in some ways, our role is similar to yours, except on a local level. Through the Oregon Workforce Partnership, we come together to try to figure out statewide how we can better leverage all of those local investments. But what we bring to the table is a clear understanding of the local issues in each one of our communities, a clear understanding of what are the complexities of working in those communities, and the ability to connect with those local businesses directly to come up with solutions that meet their needs on a day-to-day basis. In many ways, what we do parallels what some of your previous speakers spoke about, in that we bring together clustral groups, sector groups of business and industry, figure out what their needs are, and try to figure out then how to invest to support those. We oversee over $50 million in federal investments each year. Last year, over the last 5 years, we've brought in over $40 million in additional federal investments. We also support a WorkSource system that serves over 200,000 Oregonians per year. And we really believe that this is a time where we critically need innovation and new solutions. The current crisis needs long-term structural adjustments to fix those. But you also need to be looking at low-hanging fruit. We can't wait for educational reform to fix everything. We can't wait for those long-term answers. We've got businesses right now that need immediate help. One of the things I'd like to point out to you is Oregon is one of the few states that, although they've got a large investment in the emerging workforce, which is our youth population, and the transitional workforce, those who are unemployed, we have almost no investment at all in the current workforce. The only investment right now is that's directly targeted, directly organized, is a $3.9 million federal investment that is managed through our local organizations. And part of what's exciting about that investment is we've been able to bring incredible results from that. For the last 2 years, from a $7.8 million investment, we've served over 240 companies, over 13,000 employees, at an average cost of $500 per employee, with a 2-to-1 match by business. And the reason I bring this up is because there are innovative solutions that are out there. There are relatively low-cost solutions that are out there, and we need to continue to look for those and to find those. Our recommendations for you are to support the Skill Up Oregon proposal that the governor's office has put out there, as well as the cluster initiative. And I want to hand some credit to the governor's office, because they have clearly identified this issue of workforce development, and they've clearly stepped up to try to figure out how to solve this and how to help all of us figure out some effective answers. A request we have for you, as you look at other solutions, as you make new investments, is to keep them as simple as possible. Because we work so heavily with the federal investments, which is the bulk of the funding for directly workforce training as opposed to the education for enterprise, one of the things we know is they come with huge strings attached. They're very complex, very inflexible, very difficult to work with. So anything that you put forward, it would be helpful to figure out how to make it as simple, as easy to implement as possible. Anything you can do to help us with looking for efficiencies, alignments, greater accountability would be much appreciated as well. We ask you also to consider utilizing us as a resource, as a partner, as a structure that has a similar goal to yours in terms of maximizing investments and evaluating for results. And I guess the last point I would make is that we're very excited about the fact that this committee exists. This is, for us, the first time we've seen this conversation take place this way, where economic and workforce development are being talked about together. We feel it's important that this be led by the voice of business in as many ways as possible and the voice of labor in as many ways as possible, rather than the voice of existing infrastructures and hierarchies and bureaucracies interested in maintaining stability. We need to know, that's where that cluster piece becomes so incredibly important, and that sectoral piece, working together to identify how you can do this differently. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Agnes. I know that your suggestion that we keep things simple so that folks can actually utilize the help that that the government offers is advice well taken, and I suspect that every single one of us here on this committee has heard from employers in our own districts who have been frustrated. There is help out there, but there are roadblocks, there are speed bumps, there are things that make it difficult for our employers in our districts to be able to access and or utilize our help. And so it's a point very, very well taken. So thank you. Norm, if you would please introduce yourself.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Norm Eater, and I'm Executive Director of Manufacturing 21 Coalition. The coalition, for those of you who aren't familiar with us, and you have little reason to be familiar with us, formed 2 years ago. We are what Joe Courtwright just referred to as a cluster. We're a self-organizing cluster, one that has spread from a handful of companies, manufacturing companies in the Portland area, to become, at least we aspire as a statewide organization. Nearly 80 companies and provider organizations, community colleges, workforce development boards, and others are members of Manufacturing 21 Coalition. So it's a pleasure to be here. We're delighted that you exist. We are interested and focused on two interconnected issues that you've heard about this morning. One is the need for a highly motivated and skilled workforce, and the other is applied innovation. The companies who are part of our coalition, and in fact companies across the state, are dependent upon those two factors to remain globally competitive. And so we, the scope of our interests are strictly designed to address those two issues. Today our companies face severe shortages of skilled workers. The shortage will only worsen as those of us in the baby boom head for retirement. This will defy the economic trends. The demographics are the future. The training pipeline leading to our companies is largely empty. It's empty. It's not that we don't have programs. It's that there's no one in those seats. So this is a challenge we have. The people who make their way to the front door of our companies often lack the hard and soft skills necessary to succeed. And our companies every single day have to grapple with the consequences of widespread drug use and a range of social problems that end up at the front door of the workplace. And our academic institutions have retreated from the kind of applied research that our companies need. There are good reasons for this, but nonetheless, that's the fact. And as a coalition, Manufacturing 21 came together because we know these problems evolved over time. There's no simple fix for any of the issues facing us in terms of workforce and innovation. It isn't something you can deal with in one session. It's something you need a commitment to deal with over multiple sessions. But business and labor and the public sector have to be together at the same table with patience and determination over a long period of time. So our first message is we're here. And we're glad you're here, because this is going to be a long journey over a number of sessions. And we're especially grateful to Speaker Merkley for creating this committee. It's a tangible recognition that these issues, workforce and applied innovation, have arrived, and that in the state of Oregon, what matters most are high-paying jobs And we're interested in seeing that people with high-paying jobs and who have high-paying jobs get connected. For the last 2 years, we've been, as a coalition, not only growing ourselves, but we've been as active as anybody in working on developing solutions. I want to join Agnes in congratulating Governor Kulongowski and his staff for developing statewide solutions to our workforce challenges, and also mention Oregon Inc., which has included in their proposals some ideas for manufacturing. So we're very pleased that that's part of their overall agenda. We strongly support the recommendations of Oregon Inc., Skill Up Oregon Fund, and the Cluster Development Fund. The needs that we face as an industry are things that we need to think about and we need to frame. And today, I think what I want to do is cut to the quick about how we think you as a committee can frame the workforce and applied innovation issues, giving legislative priority, clear goals, and frankly, a to-do list for the state of Oregon over the coming session. So here's what we ask as a practical-minded group of manufacturers who make things every day, and those things need to work. We're interested in things that work, not necessarily in the institutions that provide them. So what can this session do, what can you as a committee do to ensure that the state has a healthy high-wage economy? And I want to thank Bob Baugh and for his comments because I get to build off of what he said. So here's our call to action. 8 points. Fill the human capital pipeline. The number one issue that we face as a state, that we face as manufacturers, is that the pipeline is empty. Retirements, the normal churn, and there's nobody to take their place. We can, if we do nothing else, we need to pay attention to that number one challenge. We have programs, but we don't have people, and we need to launch a major initiative to show young people and those who influence them that career choices are not just a bipolar choice between rocket science and fast food, that there's a lot bigger world out there, and we need to be communicating with them. And we look to you to help devise a strategy for doing that. We need to create a demand-driven workforce delivery system shaped by strong state policies, which are, I'm pleased to say, taking form already and have been over the last couple of years, and guided by local private sector leadership. The Oregon Workforce Partnership, Agnes and her colleagues, are the people on the ground who are charged with charged with managing the system. They don't so much run it, because what runs it are the people who have the money and who put the limitations on it. But nonetheless, those local boards, which are led by the private sector, are the essential ingredient in creating and delivering services at the local level that match the local need. We need to reinvent skills-based education. We can't afford to recreate the system that existed when I went to Cleveland High School in the late 1960s. There, we had Benson High School. Anybody interested in that could go there full time. But for those of us who didn't go, when I went to Cleveland, I had a shop class, and it was required that I take it. And I still remember the really cool stuff that other people built and that I admired. Someday I'll tell you about Dwayne and the guitar. But we're never going to rebuild that system. It's atrophied over time as we've cut budgets, as school districts, large, significant changes in our society. So we need to reinvent how we do skills-based education. We need to create new training tools for high school and college faculty, counselors, industry clusters that ensure connectivity to the changing needs of industry. Industry's needs are not static. As the global economy changes, as competitive environment changes, the needs change. But yet, often what's taught in the schoolhouse, in the community college, is not connected to today's needs. And it's not because people people don't want to. It's just they don't have the tools. They don't have the opportunities. So we need to figure out a way to increase the professional proficiency of the people who are teaching the next generation of workers at all levels. We need to expand high-performance learning networks to transform industry and learning. The manufacturing sector has embraced high-performance lean ideas. It's time that we took some of those, and I think many of our members could help do this, and transferred them to the public sector, to the other parts of our economy where we could apply these lean and efficient tools. We need to increase the capacity for applied research and innovation. Both Bob as well as Joe Courtwright referred to this. Manufacturing employs fully one-fifth of the Oregon employment base. And it's probably, I can't quite get the right statistic, but if you look at the family wage jobs, where manufacturers probably provide well over half of the family wage jobs in this state. Companies doing manufacturing, employers doing manufacturing, need a steady stream of applied technology. We've invested successfully in nanotechnology. There are proposals to invest in wave technology and other technologies. We need to do the same in applied technologies, as Bob Baugh said, that go directly to the shop floor to deliver innovation to companies to turn into products today, tomorrow, and the next day. And as part of that, Manufacturing 21 has been working on developing a center for manufacturing and infrastructure engineering. And this is an important part of what we talked to the Innovation Council about, and you'll hear more about it as we go into not only this session, but the 209 session. We need to restore the ethic of applied learning and research in higher education. I'm guilty. I spent a long career in higher education. So let me tell you, this is something that I've thought a lot about. Our universities were founded to engage and support applied learning way back in the 19th century. If you think about them, agriculture and mechanics. Over time, some of that focus has been eroded, again, for lots of good reasons. Follow the money, other things. I think everyone ought to learn Shakespeare and ought to read the Federalist Papers. On the other hand, it's important that there be strong connectivity between our universities and our manufacturing industry. And so we would like to see us reinvigorate this ethic through meaningful industry involvement, faculty incentives, and also targeted investments. And again, the Innovation Council has been very receptive to this idea. And finally, we think that we need to implement a private sector evaluation model to assure provider accountability and industry satisfaction. This is a really simple point. The companies who are part of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition have customers, and when they want to know if they're doing well and if their products are successful, who do they ask? They ask their customers. And so it seems to us that we can learn a lot from a very simple customer-focused approach. Are the employees who are getting trained, are the companies who are doing the hiring happy with the products that they're getting? Period. And that can guide our investments down the road and seems to us to be a pretty good standard for how well we're doing. So those are our 8 points. The one thing I haven't done is give you details, because we're going to talk about those. But let me make a point, the final point about our position, is we thought a lot about how to structure this conversation, and it's been boiled down to those 8 points. We think if, through this session, you can say as a committee, and the legislature can say as a legislature, within each of these, we now have a roadmap. We know we won't do everything we need to do to satisfy these 8 points, but we know where we're going, and we've done a couple of things, and we're going to do those things in the next biennium. Manufacturing 21 will be happy. Again, we don't care. Our issue, our concern is not about the institutions. We're concerned about the outcome, about what's produced, what the product is, because that's what our companies do every day. And we know that it isn't just about the paint. You've got to be concerned about the surface. And if you've got a rough spot on the surface, it shows through the paint. So you need more than just one solution. You need a suite of solutions. But you need them within the context of a bigger vision for the problems the state's trying to solve. Thank you.
Norm, Agnes, thank you very, very much for your excellent testimony. Questions, comments from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm struck as I listen to the two of you talk about these issues, and my long connection with public education as that developmental piece of the process, that and the difficulties that those institutions face in terms of student involvement, dropout rates, and so forth. It occurs to me that applying some of these ideas that you've described much more radically than I have seen anywhere so far might actually be part of the solution to those problems as well as to the issues that you're raising. If you want to fill the pipeline, having motivated youngsters coming out of school who have already had experience in the workforce, in apprenticeship programs, in innovative programs involving internships and training where they have supervisors at the job site and also among the faculty back at school. The kind of professional model that I'm used to as a psychologist might make a lot of sense. That doesn't address the second piece of your point, of course, which is what are we going to do right now to deal with today's issues. But I wonder if you have any comments about those thoughts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the study that the Gates Foundation did, I want to say 2-3 years ago, interviewing folks who dropped out of school and asking the question about their reasons, found that most dropouts did not drop out because they were failing in school. Most dropouts left because of a lack of relevance. And that's exactly what you're talking about, is a lack of relevance. So that piece is totally borne out by research as well as perception. And what we do know is that kids today aren't getting what we consider transformative experiences, the opportunities to take something and make something else out of them, so they lose that whole understanding of process change, which is critical to being able to manage any process, whether it's on a plant floor or whether it's in an office or whether it's in a medical health environment. So those are critical pieces. The fixes for those are long-term. But some of the work that we're doing with the cluster initiatives that we have with Manufacturing 21 and others have the potential to get at least some immediate fixes in there. For example, as business and industry are saying, yes, we want to get into those classrooms and start talking, and we're finding teachers who are saying, yes, we'd like to get you in there. Finding those low-hanging fruit is a big help with that. The Career Expo that Manufacturing 21 does every year is another piece that helps with that. But we need more of that. We need more of those opportunities to train the teachers, to get them talking with business and industry, and to connect as quickly as possible on that.
Just a follow-up. We need some major model changes, don't we? In K-12 and perhaps university level, would that be an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, from where we sit, that would be an accurate statement. I don't know if you'd like to address it to me.
Yes.
That was an easy one.
Chairman Wood, Representative Barnhart, the question, of course, is what do you do? How do you tackle those systems? And I think that's one of the reasons, if I can take you back to our 8 points, is why we chose to lay them out. When the coalition began, we had a small group of companies who complained about the system, generically, complained about everything, and said, by God, we're going to go change it. And then they fought for a moment, and they said, well, how are we going to do that? what is the first thing we're going to do? And well, we're going to go change the system. And so you can see where the dialogue goes. So we would suggest that instead a measured approach, recognizing that significant changes and transformations have to occur, whether it's work-related experiences or you name it, and choose your poison. Say, these are the things we're going to do, knowing we need to transform the system. Here's a short list that we can do today
that will begin the process. Don't start with the end, but start with the beginning. And again, that's, I think, where we've come down on this with regards to, again, trying to formulate a kind of 8-point approach, and maybe it's 6 and maybe it's 9. We don't pretend to have all the answers. But we have given, again, we've given a good deal of thought about how you might frame the question so you don't get lost in the potential solutions.
Look forward to the discussion. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Iger, I heard you say these are the 8 points at a very high level, and you're not giving us the detail. I assume that because you've had this conversation for a while that you actually have a lot of detail behind those. I would certainly like to see that detail and talk to you about that. I think that you've put a lot of thought into this, and your group has done so, and I think that we do need to develop our roadmap in not only this area but many areas. We have our roadmap for this session in a broad sense, but I believe we need to develop roadmaps in special areas, in many different areas, and this is one of them, and know where we're going over the next 8, 10, 12 years. And I would like very much to pick your brain in this particular area and see what your details are behind those 8 points.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wright, I hope when you pick my brain you don't find it empty.
I'm sure I won't.
We have. And I would note that in fact very few of the ideas we would bring forward would be unique. We have sought to use the good work that's been done by the state, by the governor's office, by the workforce investment boards, the local boards, and industry as well, and to look at mixes of public and private initiatives that could again start one down that road. Our exhortation this morning is at the beginning of the session is to say, get that roadmap. Frame your questions so that you can answer them. Don't frame them so large so that you never get out of the question. And look to the end of the day, of this session at least, where you can point to a list of things that you're doing that the state will do, and I might add that the private sector will do as well, because we are your partners. The outcome of this affects every single one of our companies, and what we will do together over the next biennium. Now, within each of these 8 categories, these 8 points, you can choose your nomenclature here, to be successful, so that we understand both context as well as initiative. And again, there have been some good ideas already put on the table. As we have gone around the state, we found some terrific ideas that are suggestive of things that might be done.
Thank you. Representative Gerard?
Actually, my questions are just follow-ups with the questions that have been asked the last two representatives. First of all, I really believe in a skill-based education, and I actually ran on that in the last election. And I was just kind of curious, since you represent a lot of manufacturing industries, if are you willing to pay an additional corporate rate in order? I'm one to ask the tough questions, if you haven't noticed that.
But, oh, was it?
Yeah, okay. Since I'm going to be on the hot seat and people are going to want me to vote one way or another, I just was kind of curious.
Good question.
If you're willing, if most of your manufacturing sector is willing to do that.
So I have to answer that question. let me give you 2 answers. And leave you with a promise.
Okay.
The first part of it is, as a new coalition, we have focused on workforce and on innovation. And frankly, business environment, tax issues, environmental issues are somebody else's issues. Now I understand the root of your question is, so if you got this stuff, would you be willing to pay for it? And I think that's not only a good question, it's the right question, and that I would be willing to take it back to the coalition, which we don't have a mechanism for such a question, but I'll create one, and because I think the connection has to be between the paying for it and the value gotten. And so if that's part of the dialogue, I think the coalition would be delighted to have that dialogue. I can't predict what the outcome will be because I haven't put that question to the members. We don't even have a forum yet to create. We don't have a forum to put it, but we can. But I think it has to be connected to the value, not as an abstract question. But here are the things within workforce and innovation that that money is going to buy you.
Follow up. One thing I absolutely disagreed with what you said, and I agreed with 99% of it. Please, I hate Shakespeare. Okay. But one thing I all that aside,
I did mention the Federalist Papers with Shakespeare.
I just never could read it. Is it an apprentice program? Is that part of... I'm just trying to get a peek as to what you're kind of looking at. I kind of think, you know, just throwing ideas out, like something for 16 to 18-year-olds to hold them in high school, like what was stated, that they just get bored and they don't see a relevancy factor. Some type of apprentice program towards the workforce, is that somewhat of what you're thinking about? Or
absolutely. AFL-CIO is part of our coalition. We're pleased to have them. I was pleased to hear my old friend Bob Baugh, who I do remember when he used to be in the state, mention the coalition. But it is, so that's certainly inclusive in our thoughts. But there are, it's not just the, it, but let me go on to give you other examples. There are apprenticeship programs. There are both the labor organized ones as well as the activities of the community colleges. Mm-hmm. There at the same time are private sector groups such as the Business Education Compact that is providing summer internships and work experiences for teachers and students who we are working with. So we don't think that there is necessarily one solution. Another example of an activity, that OIT, or Oregon Institute of Technology, last summer ran a demonstration program through their manufacturing technology program where they took high school math and science teachers who didn't know anything about manufacturing and help them develop curriculum that they could take into the classroom that was geared towards the sorts of things that manufacturers need. When I referred to one of the 8 points about improving and upgrading professional skills of our educators, they're, after all, the wholesale part of the system. And so they need to be part of it. So these would be the kinds of initiatives we would look to, look forward to having a discussion with you as we move through the session.
On behalf of the Workforce Investment Boards, this is certainly an issue that we're very interested in tackling and figuring out how to increase the opportunities for apprenticeship, and understanding that the apprentice pipeline is aging too. The average age for apprentices is getting older and older, and how do we figure out how to bring more kids into those and understand what those are? So we're definitely interested in looking at some solutions there and some ways to expand opportunities in apprenticeships.
Thank you. Well, with our commitment to high performance and trying to run things on time, Representative Holvey's going to have the last question.
Thank you. And it may be more of a comment, and just following up on Representative Girard's comments, because I had much the same question, because I think there's a lot more urgency behind the consideration you need to make around the revenues we need to actually do this. You're asking us to come forward and really get behind this, I assume, with some sort of revenue scenario where we've witnessed a disinvestment in our educational system and our skills training, and we need to make sure that our investments are really targeted to our cluster groups that are really going to improve our economy and not just be mere subsidies to individual companies with no connection to the overall workforce that we need to move our clusters forward. And so the urgency is, as I speak, I know Lane Community College is right now considering cutting all of their apprenticeship programs because of the lack of disinvestment. And as we've heard from previous speakers, you know, there's been a huge shift in who's paying for our revenues. And I think that really has to come to, you know, your group really needs to come to grips with that, because there has been a huge disinvestment from the corporate effort into our tax structure. And it's mostly the wage earners that are paying for that revenue at this point, and they're pretty well strapped, as we know, because their wages haven't been keeping up with all the rest of productivity and other items. So, you know, I urge you to move forward with those considerations on your support of increased revenues from your sector. Thank you.
Urging well taken. The disinvestment issue is one that is really at the core of how Manufacturing 21 came together. It was the realization of a downward spiral by our companies, that the programs they relied upon and they rely upon at the community colleges, the apprenticeship programs at the universities, have been caught in this double bind. The double bind is they've been disinvested in, and there aren't enough people coming into them. So if you're a university president or if you're a community college president and you have to cut your budget, where are you going to cut? You're going to cut where there aren't people. So one of the priorities we certainly have, and I just want to reiterate, the number one priority is filling the pipeline. Without people, the investment doesn't matter. Without people, the jobs won't be filled. And so we need to focus on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you both so very, very much. Agnes, good to see you. It's been
good
a long time.
Good to see you,
good to see you again.
Much.
And Norm, I just want to say that it was so great, your presentation and your 8 points. Just like Vice Chair Riley, you've whetted the appetite. I'm ready for the full meal deal, so I can't wait to pick your brains here.
I'll come back at your call.
Thank you so very, very much. Just for the committee's reference and any of the folks in the audience would like to know, next hearing, we're going to be hearing from some high-performance companies individually from some of our districts, and any of the committee members who have some high performers in your district that you'd like to make sure we hear from, this would be your last opportunity, I think, to let Ellen know about that. With that, thank you all so very, very much. It was our witnesses that made this session so successful. I thank you all for your input and your willingness to help us. And with that, we stand adjourned.